I think it's very challenging to be able to scale any business if you don't have any level of predictability within your revenue, and it's always kind of living and dying by larger projects.
Hello and welcome to the Gross Profit Podcast. My name is James Kennedy. I'm the CEO and co-founder at ProcurementExpress.com. We take the hassle out of managing your spend without buying an ERP, but we are not here to talk about that today. Instead, I've got Chris Gwynn from MidwestCFO.com, who is going to tell us how he added $1 million in EBITDA to a marketing agency client's books within 6 months. But the trick is anyone can do that. Any half-decent CFO can do it, but he did it without timesheets because timesheets are the thing that creatives push against. I know they hate them. They're far too snowflakey to be doing anything new numbers orientated, like measuring their time. They go nuts when you try and do it. So what do you do? How do you do your cost accounting if client is pushing back because they don't want to spend their time buried in paperwork? Well, I think Chris is going to give us an answer today, maybe the answer. Chris, why don't you kick us off, though, by telling us something about you that your colleagues might not know about you?
Well, thanks again, James, for having me on. Super excited to be joining the Gross Profit Podcast. As far as something that some of my folks in, you know, just some of my colleagues and some of the folks in the audience might not know about me, but not the best looking fella right now. But surprisingly, when I was, I guess, under 1 year old, my parents or my dad was in residency for medical school, and we were living in Toronto. And to help support my family, I was a baby model in some local pamphlets for some department stores in the greater Toronto area within Canada.
Okay, well, don't sell yourself short. We are on YouTube here, so leave a comment if you think Chris is a fine, sure, fine-looking guy and is no problem there. And just because your parents employed child labor at the early age, I'm sure we won't hold that against them. So that's the most unusual icebreaker I've had on the show. Well done so far. So from baby model, normally I ask, you know, well, how does being a baby model influence your CFO career? But I think that might be a bit of a stretch. So we'll go straight into your credibility, I guess. Not everyone gets to go on the Gross Profit Podcast. You got to be the creme de la creme. So tell us, how did you get to call yourself a fractional CFO? How did you get credentialed? And how has it led you to this point of being able to help your clients?
Yeah, great question. I've always had a passion for finance and operations and driving growth and profit. Profitability. I did my undergrad in accounting and finance at Marquette University. That's in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, for folks unfamiliar with that, where that's located at. And then earned my CFA charter, which is essentially kind of the corporate finance investment equivalent of the CPA exam. Shortly after I graduated, worked in corporate finance for a number of years, and then in portfolio management investments before taking on a director of finance and operations role for a small business within the Midwest. Did that for a number of years, and then ultimately took the entrepreneurial leap and really have always had the itch to start my own business. And so started my first business. It was called Great Lakes Advisory. It was more of a management consulting style company. Did a lot of process improvement, process documentation, SEs, training development, and really helping folks to ensure that all of their processes were followed by all and building more consistency within the overall delivery of their service or their product or their operations. And I built it all up from zero to a couple million and ultimately built it all out through primarily, I would say, maybe about 50% of just my own network and folks that I've known throughout the years. And also throughout, I guess I participated in the Entrepreneurs Organization. That is a global organization, but I participated in the Chicago chapter. And so grew it a ton just through my network and word of mouth and other clients, and really enjoyed the work. Yet it wasn't necessarily my true passion or expertise. Did a lot more operations compared to more of the nitty-gritty analytical, I guess, skills that I kind of more prefer. And so ultimately, I grew to a point that I was very happy with, but I really wanted to get back to my passion and my unique abilities. And so ultimately approached one of our strategic partners and successfully exited it a couple of years ago. And then at the time, I started Midwest CFO about the same time.
Interesting. So you told me that you had an interesting marketing strategy to help build up Great Lake Consulting, which was unusual and not a million miles from what I'm doing right now. So maybe you could tell me a bit about that and where you got the inspiration for it.
I guess it was just to clarify, Great Lakes Advisory, but yeah, it was a consulting firm. But as far as kind of the marketing approach, we did a couple of different things. I did a lot of SEO. So I was trying to build out kind of all of our inbound leads. And so learned, being a first-time entrepreneur, learned a lot about marketing. I don't have a background in marketing. So I learned it all through experience and then reading just absurd amount of sales and marketing books out there, but built out a lot of SEO and just organic traffic and increasing our overall domain authority. So I did that through using an SEO agency. I also partnered up with kind of a do follow kind of high quality backlinks to be able to increase the overall domain authority and just drive more traffic to our website. Built out a really strong lead magnet that then funneled into all of our email newsletter or email newsletter subscribers, and then put out an email newsletter about every 3 to 4 weeks or so, and then reposted all of our content on social media. So that was kind of more the, I guess, traditional digital marketing strategy. And then I ran my own podcast as well called the Agency Accelerator that was really focused on helping digital agencies to be able to really just share their overall growth playbook and share some of their subject matter expertise in order to be able to help other digital agencies grow, and generated a lot of inbound, or I guess a lot of not inbound, but a lot of leads and sales through connecting with the right audience. So I was specifically targeting a lot of folks on the Inc. 5000 list, all fairly, if you're unfamiliar, it's kind of the fastest 5,000 companies in America, I believe. And I think it's only in America. I'm not sure if it's global, but it's the fastest 5,000 companies or small businesses in America. There was a fair amount of digital marketing and marketing agencies on there. So I would do a lot of cold outreach that to specifically reach out to the founders or the CEOs, because those were always the decision makers and the folks that I wanted to be able to have featured on my podcast, and then brought them on for an interview and did somewhat of a pre-call, I guess, to the overall podcast, and allowed for more of a non-salesy approach to learn a little bit more about their business, some of their issues, some of their experience, what some potential topics that we might want to cover on the podcast. And that in turn translated into a handful of opportunities that I was able to convert into sales.
Interesting. So asking for a friend, like it's possible to do lots and lots of podcasts and not generate any sales opportunities. So did you have to, because it's very easy to say, hey, let's do a podcast, let's chat, you know, and then, you know, you do the podcast, you put it out and you wander off, you never see each other again. And that's the end of that. And so when you started, did you have any tricks but any tactics that would help funnel towards a sales opportunity versus just, oh, that was nice, and now I'm on the internet. Thanks for that, Chris.
Related specifically to the podcast?
Yeah. I'm wondering, well, I'll just share my own experience. Like I've done over the time, I started early on, I would just do interviews, and then I figure out, okay, well, this is fine, but then I need to, you know, progress, create some sort of pipeline out of it. It's not for every guest, but for some guests. So then I would have them fill out after this, you'll get a sort of production sheet. And one of the questions is, you know, in the production sheet is, do you have a client that could use Procurement Express? And if you say yes, then I follow up and say, hey, I noticed you have a client that might use Procurement Express. Would you mind if I showed you how that works? That's my kind of method, right? But it wasn't working until I put that step in there. Like I wasn't progressing anything before. So I was wondering did you find for a consultancy business, it was enough just to spend the time with them, they knew about you, and it would just over time naturally happen?
I guess I kind of tried to make it a little bit more organic, I guess, and just tried to not be too pushy with it. But I would always ask about some of their issues and some of the things, some of the strategic problems that they're looking to be able to solve. And I would use that as, hey, maybe this is something that we could potentially talk about on the podcast if they're comfortable. Or I would also kind of put on my sales hat during that and say, oh, well, if some of these problems I can solve with them, then I think it's worth a follow-up conversation. So I didn't try to necessarily make it a hard sale where, hey, are you interested in buying services from Great Lakes Advisory? But if they brought up, well, hey, we've got a lot of, I guess, some operational issues and folks aren't really following some of the processes, we're having trouble getting folks up to speed. And then that's kind of a like an immediate red flag, or my ears go up that, hey, they potentially might benefit from my previous company's services. So, and then I would always put them on our email newsletter. I would also try to focus a lot on really focusing on their, like really showcasing their experience, their subject matter expertise, and focusing on topics that are really important and that they are passionate about and that they just are very knowledgeable, then in hopes that if they can share their experience, their playbooks, kind of some of their best practices, some of their learning experiences and shares, in hopes of being able to attract other similar type of listeners, that hopefully my audience, I would wanted to make it, I guess, similar to the guests that I'm featuring also on the podcast, so that they would not only listen, but and potentially convert, but also potentially be interested in maybe joining the podcast in the future. And then I would also try to add a lot of value where I would specifically feature them in one of our email newsletter. I would add a backlink to their website. I would also share a ton of B-roll content and a couple of, so all of like the raw files, as well as the full like YouTube and links, as well as a specific blog post written about them. That was where we included the backlinks. And then I created a couple of other, I guess, some social media assets that they could feel free to use on their website. So the whole goal was to also focus on, since I guess I was trying to target a handful of folks that actually had a decent sized audience, in hopes that they would also repost or reshare that episode. And that ultimately drove a lot of traffic too.
Very good. So I'm curious about people who, you know, they exit one business and then they start a new one, right? Out of the frying pan into the fire. But you obviously feel like this is more your niche. You mentioned that the analytical work you're attracted to, and the dog whistle I heard there was the operational side is messy, right? So was it the, you know, process implementation is not always a happy journey, if I can say that. So what was it about that business that you learned, okay, this is a good thing about it, but this is why I'm happy to just focus on a subset, which is the financial side. Is a management consultant, see, sort of ultimately quite a stressful business to run? Was that part of the reason you stepped away, or was it just too many human beings involved, or what was your motivation?
That was definitely one of the factors. I think part of maybe, I don't know if I necessarily have like a huge ego, but I think everyone wants to feel at least appreciated and valued. And I think having kind of a business where you're working on process improvement, a lot of times you're getting down to some of the very, you're getting very into the weeds and maybe a couple of layers or levels below some of the different decision makers. And sometimes it's swimming upstream where you're trying to get the buy-in of the folks that are actually performing these services, yet they're also feeling a little bit insecure that we're working on and not only improving their processes where they might feel, I guess, scrutinized, or that we're, I guess, criticizing their work, but also that we're documenting how they're doing their work. So then there was this, some slight resentment maybe, or insecurity that they felt like, hey, if we're documenting and building out these training modules and exactly how I do my work, maybe I could potentially feel replaceable. So I would often work with a lot of, I guess, when working to build out these process improvement, there would be some senior level management, but a lot of times it was more of the, it wasn't always like the CEO or the business owner. It was a lot of times level down or two with managers and some of the individual rockstar employees or contributors within a particular department. And I think that created some challenges. On top of it, I didn't always love that the business model was not very reoccurring in nature. And I think it's very challenging to be able to scale any business if you don't have any level of predictability within your revenue. And it's always kind of living and dying by larger projects. And so it puts a lot of burden on your sales and marketing to be able to replenish and bring in new projects. And on top of that, the cash flow is a little bit lumpier, where you can get kind of some large peaks and troughs where cash flow, you can have some phenomenal months and some months where it's a little bit barren. So I think that's just an overall challenge from a financial perspective as well. And that's kind of where having a model that is a little bit more reoccurring in nature, that you're consistently adding value mm-hmm. for your clients and for your customers, just becomes a little bit more manageable, not only from a profitability, from a cash flow perspective, but also just from a time management and just a capacity and workforce planning as well.
Yeah. Okay. That's a great thought there. So the CFO is famously a very sort of coveted role, directly working with the CEO normally, if not the board as a whole, which is nice. And then now that you mention it, there's just a natural rhythm to the CFO task, right? There's planning, there's quarterly planning, there's board reports, there's, you know, there's month ends that have to be reviewed, etc. It's just got a rhythm to it, which means that you're not going to be there for a short time. You're going to be a longer time engagement.
I mean, one of the nice things is that it's, for the most part, it all aligns with just a calendar year, with month end and quarter end and annual planning mm-hmm. and updating on a reoccurring cadence based on a calendar year. So it's a little bit easier to kind of plan around and staff around.
Very good. So you had an exit, I have to ask, did you buy a toy? Anytime anyone has an exit, I have to ask, was there a toy you couldn't resist going and rewarding yourself with?
I guess nothing too materialistic that I bought, but we did buy a new house. So we have a young son that's about 18 months old. We've got another one on the way. So we bought a new house recently. So that was
helpful. Very good. You're going to need it. Your life is going to be tough, or not tough. It's going to be different for the next 2 years. So yeah, you're going to need a bit of square footage to help with that. All right. So you mentioned, you know, you have actually an array of different types of clients, but you know, the fastest growing businesses and often fastest dying is businesses are agencies and marketing agencies. And you have a particular case study here where you were able to turn them around and add $1 million in EBITDA to the bottom line. EBITDA isn't quite bottom line, isn't that right? So middle line, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, EBITDA, I use, for folks that aren't familiar, just stands for earnings before interest, tax, depreciation, and amortization. And in the accounting and finance world, it's more of a true measure of your core profitability. So it removes some of the non-cash expenses with depreciation and amortization. It also just is more of a true reflection of your true business operations. So it doesn't include other income, other expenses, some of the non-true business income, net income, or net other income. And it's also commonly used to be able to, as a multiple or as a factor in your overall valuation of the company.
Okay, so we'll skip over Charlie Munger estimating, you know, EBITDA to be bullshit earnings. But the important thing you had my attention there is it's used as a multiple for valuing a business, for better or worse, right? So, but that's the sort of corporate finance lingo everyone's used to. So let's just stick with that. So that's a very real reason to focus on your EBITDA versus anything else. So You said non, let me break this down a little bit. When you say non-cash items, like what does that really mean? Because, you know, my accountant has told me we should spend all this effort, you know, accruing for expenses and amortizing things. And then you're telling me, no, we're going to strip that all out again. Why do we do it in the first place if we take it out again? Like, what is a non-cash item and why do we take it out again?
Well, it's not so much that it's not important to include. Well, let's just say, for an example, let's just make the example very easy. You buy a $50,000 asset in cash. That $50,000 asset sits on your balance sheet, but then you're amortizing it over or depreciating it over 5 years. So it's essentially going to depreciate or amortize about $10,000 per year. You already had a cash outlay in year one of $50,000, but then in all the following years, that $10,000 in amortization, you're not actually having a cash outlay of $10,000. You're just writing off essentially the asset down to its book value or down to zero, and just making this simple example. So if you showed a $10,000 amortization or depreciation expense in that year, it wouldn't necessarily be 100% accurate because you actually would have, well, it's just not really, you'd actually have more cash in that year. Or if it showed, if you're only looking at that calendar year in a vacuum, you'd actually have about $10,000 more in cash.
Right. So in your example there, let's say the second year that after that expense is incurred, is the $10,000 in the EBITDA or not? Is it like, is it included or do you take it in or is it taken out for the purpose of that? Like, or do you, so it's not cash accounting we're talking about. It's not quite accrual accounting. It's something in the middle. That's what I'm getting so far.
Yeah, no, it is accrual accounting. Well, I guess we're kind of talking about two different things. From an overall, I guess, tax perspective, it's always helpful to have as many expenses as possible because you want to lower your overall taxable income. So depreciation is tax deductible, same thing with interest. And so those are things that you do want to depreciate against and or just you want to deduct from your overall tax income. And ideally, you're paying as few less taxes as humanly possible. No one really wants to increase their overall tax burden. But from an overall valuation perspective and just creating kind of an apples to apples comparison, folks like to use EBITDA because it's just more of a true measure. Not every single business is as capital intensive. So there's some folks that have a ton of assets on their balance sheet, and that ultimately lowers, if you factor in depreciation and amortization, it'll significantly lower your overall net income, which is it's EBITDA plus or minus your net other income minus your interest paid and taxes. So if folks that are more capital intensive or more leveraged, they have maybe more debt on their balance sheet, might actually have a significantly lower net income. But if you want to try to create kind of an apples to apples comparison, especially within the same industry, it's just more of helpful to kind of strip away some of those so that you can create a more comparable evaluation.
Okay, so let's get on to this client then. When you got to them, they were actually making a slight EBITDA loss, was it? Or what was the situation you found when you showed up on day one?
So I did work with, so we were working with an agency. They were doing about $7.5 million in annual revenue. About, I think they had about 70% of all of their revenue was in about one of that service line was only about 30% gross margin, their overall gross margin. They had a couple of other service lines as well that were maybe a little bit lower than that, was about, so the overall gross margin was about 26%. And then they had, I mean, they weren't at a loss, but anything sub 10% gross or sub 10% EBITDA is not necessarily, I guess, on life support, but it just can create some overall cash flow constraints. And ideally, we're targeting kind of plus 10%, and if we're really trying to optimize for profitability, closer to maybe kind of 20% or higher EBITDA margins, especially for a B2B professional service. So anytime we're working with a B2B professional service, specifically maybe a digital marketing agency or web development agency, typically want to target about 50% gross margin, meaning that your cost of service or your COGS represents 50% of your revenue. The other 50% is gross margin. And then ideally you're spending 30% or less on all of your SG&A expenses. SG&A meaning all of your sales, general administrative expenses, more of the sales, marketing, some of the HR, IT that doesn't necessarily need to scale exponentially or proportionally with your revenue. And you can start to experience some economies of scale. So if you're generating 50% or higher gross margin, 30% less SG&A, that'll translate into 20% or higher EBITDA. And so when we encountered or started working with this particular client, they were at an overall gross margin of about 26%, which on about $7.5 million is about $2 million-ish in gross margin. And then they had about 7%, around 7% EBITDA, which is about $525 or so in kind of EBITDA. And what we encountered was I think this is kind of a common thing that happens with a lot of business owners, because the way that a lot of times their overall accounting and their books and their chart of accounts are set up, it's we want to just make sure that things are set up from a compliance perspective, and we want to make sure that income is categorized as income. We want to make sure that expenses are categorized as expenses. And so what it leaves a lot of folks is essentially kind of a black box where we know what maybe our top line revenue is. That's, we can read that off of a P&L or an income statement is. We know maybe what our bottom line net income is, but there's a lot going on in between there. And for a lot of different companies and agencies, you might also have a couple of different service or product lines as well. And each of those product lines or service lines might also carry kind of a different gross margin. We might have different costs attributed to different service lines or different product lines. And so when we discovered this client, what we helped them to do was to overhaul their entire chart of accounts and break out each of the individual kind of revenue centers or their different service lines and build out kind of a matching revenue line with matching cost of service accounts and associating all of their labor costs, some of the tools and software, some of the other materials that went into their service and their hardware, and all attributing that in order to be able to calculate kind of a more accurate reflection of their gross margin. On top of it, we also leveraged a kind of a payroll platform. Specifically, it was Rippling, which is an awesome PEO, HRIS payroll software. But what it also allows you to do is to also create actually time splits where you can allocate labor cost based off of kind of a percentage of time that an employee is spending within a particular category. And so for this client, I believe they have around like 40-ish employees. So there's a fair amount of different team members. A lot of them were working in just one particular service line, but as a lot of folks in running a small business knows, many times some of the leaders in the organizations might be wearing multiple hats, where a portion of their labor might be in sales, or a portion of it might be in one service line, a portion of it might be in maybe an executive bucket. And so what we helped them to do, rather than, they did have actually time tracking data. And so we did kind of leverage some historical data to be able to kind of inform how we'd want to kind of allocate these costs. But what we did is we took a look, did an analysis of some of the historical trends and job titles and how and each of the responsibilities of these employees, and then allocated a portion of their overall labor burden to particular service or departments. And what that allowed us to do is to better understand that hey, we've got a couple of service lines, one particular that is about 70% of your overall business, yet it's about half of where it's only generating about 26% of gross margin. And ideally, we're targeting maybe 50% or more of your gross margin. And so if your gross margin, really true top line revenue, because that's kind of what's left over and what's available for the rest of all of your SG&A expenses, and still need to have leftover for just having some proceeds left over for profitability. But if you're generating only 26%, it's going to be kind of challenging to really have kind of a higher than 20% EBITDA margin. That would mean that you're only spending kind of less than 6% on your overall SG&A. And so being able to, one, pinpoint that, hey, this is kind of a primary, this is the lifeblood or one of the primary financial engines of your business is this, I guess, this particular service line. The service line was also it was more one-time in nature. So they also did have other reoccurring services and upselled those businesses into or those clients into. But it was still important that we don't want to necessarily have an enormous loss leader when this is still a significant portion of your overall revenue. And so what I helped them to do is, I mean, gross margin, it's really kind of just a factor of your overall pricing, and it's also a factor of the overall costs and expenses that are attributed to it. And so to be able to improve your gross margin is, one, we really got to take a fine-tooth comb of all the expenses and all the labor that is associated with that particular service line, and also see kind of where kind of our prices are at and compared to the overall market and some of your competitors, but also just taking a look at when was the last time we actually increased our overall cost. And so what I took a look at was looking through all of their historical agreements over the last 3 years. And for the most part, they hadn't really increased any of their prices in probably over 2 years. So their prices, for the most part, were about static. They're selling this particular service line for just about the same rates and for just about every customer. They were scoped, but they were still kind of about the same price, charge price for each of these different projects. Yet all of their costs, and for the most part, this is a more labor intensive business. So folks are receiving salary and compensation increases. There are also benefits get typically a little bit more expensive every single year. So your costs are rising, yet your overall charge prices are staying the same, which ultimately eats into your overall gross margin. And so one was just being able to actually begin to roll out kind of a new pricing menu and the ability to better kind of scope out some of these engagements to ensure that they are not, I guess, undercharging for some of their services, for some of the out of scope items, but then also identifying that, hey, through some of the capacity planning and some utilization rates that, because again, they did still track time, help them to better understand that they were carrying a little bit of excess labor within this department. There was also a couple of unnecessary expenses that we were able to kind of eliminate. And then from that overall experience, they grew the revenue in probably less than about 6 months, still grew at about 7%. So they moved from about $7.5 million up to about $8 million on kind of a trailing 12-month basis. But then we also, because of all the changes that we made, we were able to actually improve their overall gross margin from about 26% up to about 48%. So about a 22% overall increase, and a lot of that all funneled down to bottom line profitability. And so moving it from about a 7% EBITDA business up to about 18% EBITDA. So adding about 11% in bottom line EBITDA, or about $1 million in EBITDA. And at the time, their valuation, just probably conservatively, was maybe trading at maybe about 2x EBITDA. And so before, they were maybe about 525. So 2 times 525 is maybe about 1,050,000 or so. And probably would have increased. We did increase it likely and kind of compared to some of their other competitors, at least probably at least another turn to maybe at least 3 times. So moving it up to about nearly 1.5 at 3 times moves you up to about 430-ish. So increasing the overall valuation by about 3.25 or so.
Okay. So it wasn't necessary to go crazy with the timesheeting, although it does sound like they had some in place, but I guess there's a lot of people who, you know, there's sales teams, there's other operations and overhead people who don't timesheet, but just looking at the salary system or the looking at how you, what the, you can tag things within Rippling that help you to give you that breakdown. And I guess the turnover of the projects was slow enough that was accurate, was it? Like, so, you know, if you do that every, if you're on a turnaround of like a couple of week project, like you're installing in a home business, for example, you're doing a project in someone's house, it's hard to track projects like that. But if it's a web dev project, those projects can last 3 or 6 months. So if you're surveying 3 or 6 months, that's good enough, right?
Yes, exactly.
Very good. So, all right. So, well, maybe you come back when the business does exit and we can chat about what they bought for a toy on the back of your, you were able to do for them. So maybe you can tell me a little bit more about, like you've mentioned this, you know, B2B professional services is your sweet spot in terms of customers. Like who should reach out to you and how can they do that, I guess?
So our ideal audience is going to be a lot of growth-oriented businesses, ideally located in the United States. They're typically about $3 to maybe $10 million in annual revenue. Some of the verticals that we're primarily focusing in on are, as I've kind of alluded to earlier, B2B professional services, which I would categorize digital marketing agencies under, but we're also serving a lot of IT managed services, home services, SaaS, and then there's an operating model out there called EOS or the Entrepreneurial Operating System. And we'll also work with a lot of leadership teams and businesses that run on that operating model. It is an industry agnostic operating model, but we'll help sit in on their finance seat within their accountability chart and offer financial leadership and participate in all of their strategic planning and their L10s and the quarterlies, their annuals, and also own the data components and building out them KPI dashboards.
Very good. Very good. And how can people get in touch with you, Chris?
Yeah, I would love if anyone has experienced some challenges with cash flow, or they're not certain why they're not more profitable, or they're not getting enough insights from their bookkeeper or their accountant and need someone with more financial expertise to really drive growth, scale, and profitability, feel free to reach out to us at www.midwestcfo.com. I've also got an excellent guide on there on 10 ways to be able to increase the overall valuation of your company. Ton of really actionable, easy to implement strategies that I've also personally implemented for a lot of our clients. So feel free to download that complimentary guide, or you can also follow us on LinkedIn or reach out to us directly from our website.
Very good. Thanks. And thank you for listening. If you're still listening, congratulations. Your special reward for getting this far deep into the podcast is to be able to go to procurementexpress.com/newsletter. Now, why would you want to be on our newsletter? That's what I'm hearing you think right now. I'll give you 3 good reasons. Well, every week now, we've discovered that people are most interested. Let's say, I wouldn't call it schadenfreude, but we can learn a lot from other people's mistakes. So now what we are doing in the newsletter is we are gathering news stories about waste, fraud, and abuse from SMBs in the last week, and putting them in the newsletter so we can all learn from them. So we've had Naomi Campbell, poor Naomi, in our newsletter for the charity that she ran, falling foul of, let's say, prudent spend practices within their business. We've had local authorities, and we've had good old plain old small businesses that have fallen foul of waste, fraud, and abuse in their business. So I wouldn't say we're going to laugh at them. Maybe we can learn from them and put processes in place to make sure that we don't end up in the newsletter one day. So if for anything else, a bit of vicarious entertainment, please sign up. You'll also get to keep up with all the podcasts we're releasing And that's your special reward for being able to make it this far. Chris, thanks very much for being on the show. I really enjoyed chatting to you.
Of course. Thank you so much, James.